Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David Silkenet in Edinburgh. I'm joined, as always, by Frank Cogliano. How are you doing, Frank?
I'm great, David. Great, as always.
It is impeachment day in the House, so it's an interesting day to be talking about all things. But today we've got a very special guest, and that is Megan Hunt, who has been teaching with us at the University of Edinburgh for several years, and we are very lucky to have her on the podcast. Welcome, Megan.
Thank you, David. Thank you. Glad to finally
yes.
be here.
Yes, we've been intending to get Megan on for several months, so we're really happy to have
her. To make this happen. I'm always curious about how British people get interested in American history, because you were born and raised here, as opposed to Frank and I, who are guests in your fine country. How did you originally get interested in American history?
What's your deal, Megan?
it's a question. I think lots of our listeners have. People often ask me, like, why are people who are not Americans interested in American history? You know, why do we even have students? And obviously, we have a lot of students. And so, for you, what's the origin story?
I suppose for me, it was something that I wasn't particularly exposed to at school, to be perfectly honest. There wasn't a huge amount of US history in terms of what I was taught at school. I think we did the Cold War and that was about it. So I didn't do anything kind of beyond that. And I think, but obviously in terms of popular culture, it was always something that was kind of hugely significant. And I think the main issue for me that I remember was obviously with George W. Bush and this idea that British people's perception of America really shifted, and whilst I was probably too young to fully appreciate why when he was first elected, it did that kind of sense of change and that sense of actually being kind of embarrassed to be associated with the United States seemed to kind of creep into our kind of political rhetoric, at least certainly initially, and then obviously, as we know, we were much more complicit in many of the things that Bush was involved in than we maybe wanted to admit at the time. And so I ended up doing American studies for my undergraduate, which was partly a kind of practical measure because I actually loved school, which is probably not that surprising for someone who went on to do a PhD and wanted to become an academic. But I really loved school, and at sixth form, in terms of my A-levels, I did politics, I did English literature, I did history. And I did philosophy, and I basically wanted to keep doing all of them. And American studies, by being interdisciplinary, allowed me to do all of those things. So to be perfectly honest, that initial decision was probably more rooted in not wanting to make a decision at 18 rather than it being specifically about America. The rest is history. And I think it's been interesting watching the waves of student interest in America. So obviously when I was first studying America with a Bush presidency, and then this kind of idea that Europe flocked to the idea of America again under Obama, and then obviously now we're kind of like enjoying our distance again, shall we say, culturally. And so I think that's been really interesting to chart, to watch how students engage with America under an Obama presidency that they often identify with quite strongly in Britain, and then now where it's a very easy kind of entrance into American history now is students trying to make sense of what they're seeing every day on the news, social media, things like that, and it's kind of all around them. So I think that's the kind of thing that I have found most interesting, is how that kind of presidential politics seems to really seep out into, you know, potentially bringing people in, but also pushing people away and alienating them in terms of whether or not they identify with the US.
That's really interesting. Do you think that the recent election results here in the UK, and when we spoke last week, the results were still coming in, but we now have a clearer idea of what's happened. How do you think that factors into this? Just because I've seen a lot of commentary, some of which is persuasive, some of which not, arguing that Britain and America are kind of in sync politically in ways that many people in Britain and America might not be comfortable with, but anyway, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think sometimes the some of those tendencies and some of those pieces are quite lazy, and there's just this kind of assumption that the two are very similar. Right. That actually, you know, this idea that we're all following this kind of like wave to the right, and there's nothing we can do about it, which I think is kind of inherently a bit lazy. Mm-hmm. But I do think what the interesting thing is, as you've said, that the results that we've seen, it's hard to deny that you know that the kind of power of the kind of the idea of Brexit and all of these things that have been sort of linked to Trump in some way are clearly more pervasive and more powerful than maybe some of us wanted to admit. And I think what's interesting for me is that I do think that even on the right in this country, there is a kind of perception that, you know, Trump is so completely out there and so completely on a different scale in terms of his kind of his rhetoric, and that we would never be, that we would never kind of succumb to anything quite as problematic as that. And I think what we've seen with the recent election is that we are definitely not occupying any kind of moral high ground. And I think it's interesting because to me that pans out in so many different ways, because a lot of the students I teach are obviously studying civil rights, they're studying race in America, and often that's their first exposure to any kind of, you know, sort of historical engagement with race, because we clearly do that very badly if when we ever do it at all in this country. We just don't engage with our own histories of race very often. And so I think there's a tendency to see America as the problem, whether that's race, whether that's kind of right-wing politics, whether it's Trump's kind of lack of statesmanship, and assume that we are inherently above that. And I think we're gradually seeing more and more people having to recognise that some of that rhetoric is obviously has a powerful hold here. But we're not engaging with it in any of the ways that we should be.
I mean, one thing you mentioned earlier that you studied the Cold War in school before you went to university, and I know you've done some research on this, but what is it that British students learn about the civil rights movement in school and the ways in which sort of textbooks and other things shape that, and then how does that shape when they show up in your classroom? So I wonder if you could just sort of tell us what is it you think that British students learn, because it is a topic that is often taken in high school.
Yeah, that's true. So I've done quite a bit of research into textbooks and kind of curricula and materials in the UK. And the main things that I've picked up on is that the actual presentation of the movement and the presentation of key figures, particularly Martin Luther King, is almost identical to how he's presented in the US in terms of the events that are prioritised, the fact that he is prioritised over everyone else, and his life becomes the kind of narrative. And so that is entirely, you know, almost to a T, it's exactly the same. But I do think that how that's then used is quite different, because I think the main distinction between what I've seen from US scholarship on kind of school materials and textbooks is that there is this kind of overarching narrative of American progress, and that King was the right person at the right time to move America in the direction it needed to go in. Whereas I don't think we quite subscribe to that idea of kind of perfectibility in this country. I think we're more critical of the US, obviously, because we're not invested in that kind of national project, obviously. But at the same time, it allows us to displace ideas of race and racial tension and assume that they are solely American problems without acknowledging our own involvement either in those American problems in the first place or obviously our own closer to home. So I think whilst the narrative is very similar, it's used for quite different effect. So King is kind of becomes this American hero, who becomes a national hero in US context, which is then strips him of all of his actual political ideas and his radicalism. But in the UK, it's used as it's something that we kind of convince ourselves that it's an American problem. We never had, in inverted commas, you know, such pronounced issues, and so we don't then see such pronounced effects today. And that while I don't think many of our students would assume that we don't have any racial tensions in Britain, I think you would be, it's very rare that you find a student who's prepared to put British problems on the same scale as US problems. And it's often the first time that they've really engaged with kind of ideas about kind of, you know, critical race theory, as opposed to just this happened, and kind of quite linear history. American history is often the first time that they've actually engaged with any kind of real critical faculties to kind of assess those events outside of just this happened and this, you know. I think it helps us. We have a kind of amnesia about our own racial tensions, and having the US's kind of very magnified problems, both past and present, allows us to deflect that attention. And that's what students have been, in my experience, that's what students have been encouraged to do up until this point. And it's quite hard to kind of train them out of that. And I quite often do surveys with them at the beginning of the course to see what they think about race in Britain before they take the course, and whether they think these courses they're taking on the US have any correlation to what's happened or happening in Britain. And usually, apart from a few maybe kind of who are already making those connections and assuming that, you know, that know that there are things to be gained from this, the overwhelming response is usually no. I'm interested in this, but it doesn't actually relate to my life in Britain, which I think is quite
interesting. 42% of our students here at Edinburgh come from outside of the UK. And in history and in art subjects more generally, a significant proportion of those are actually from the United States. So have you noticed a difference in the classroom when you're teaching the history of civil rights in the United States between British students and non-British students, particularly American students?
Yeah, I mean, I think the common comments I get from US students is that they haven't that they feel that by studying this stuff outside of the UK, they're being given a different lens, and that we're maybe discussing ideas in a manner that is more critical than perhaps they're used to. So I think that kind of ties into this idea of, you know, often in the America, particularly in the sort of American school system, it is taught as a kind of, it's part of our path to becoming greater. Mm. And yes, we recognise that things were bad, but they're a lot better now. And
it's very Whiggish.
Yeah, yes. It's very kind of triumphal. Yeah, exactly. And so I think what I always do is I actually start with, on my civil rights course, for example, that runs for the entire year, we in terms of our actual chronology, we kind of start around the 1930s with the New Deal and kind of unionization and things like that. But in week one, where it's more sort of introductory, we actually engage with articles about today. So things that engage with mass incarceration or engage with kind of segregation in cities like Atlanta and kind of public transport and debates around very, very contemporary issues that literally show the legacy of slavery and segregation in America, you know, in daily life. And so we start with that, and then we almost kind of like build back up to it again. So by starting with those things, I think it kind of brings it home from the beginning that whilst obviously this is a historical course, it is engaging explicitly in things that have manifestations today. And basically, I encourage you to bring those things in as much as you can. And actually, you know, if things are happening in the news, then how do they link to the things that we're doing in this course? So we actually start with quite a stark indictment of actually how, you know, how race plays out in America today, which I think is sometimes a little shocking for all of the students, I think, but I think particularly for some of the American students who've previously studied civil rights as a progressive narrative upwards, and we're kind of starting at the bottom and kind of trying to sort of navigate it that way, if that makes sense. So I think that's usually a bit of a wake-up call that actually this isn't going to be a triumphal narrative of a civil rights movement that ends in 1965. This is a, you know, basically from the 1930s through to the present. And so we almost kind of start on this sort of negative point of how have we got here? You know, so that whilst there will be many triumphant moments throughout the course, that's not where we're kind of fixated on that idea of progress as kind of inevitable. And I think that's the thing that they seems to differ from what they've done before. That these courses kind of build up to 65 or maybe even 68 and then everything's better now. Whereas we're starting with, what are the biggest problems around race today? You know, mass incarceration, segregated housing, you know, inequalities, income inequalities and things like that.
Interesting.
In some ways, it doesn't. The way you're teaching the civil rights movement doesn't actually sound all that radically different from the way it's taught in the U.S. You know, and I think lots of students that you and I get, Frank, that say the same thing. Oh, American students say, well, we want to get a different perspective taking our classes here. And in some ways, the perspective actually hasn't changed that much crossing the Atlantic. The perspective is different going from high school to university, as much as it is anything else.
Yeah, I think that's true, but I think even the students that have studied it in a British context, who they may have learnt the same content, but that sense of triumphalism isn't really there. And I think British students are naturally more cynical of the kind of rhetoric around civil rights as a kind of, as an end point, than I think some of the American ones are, initially anyway. So I think that's the only real distinction that I noticed in the actual high school materials is that in some respects, the British ones actually do give more attention to people like Malcolm X, people who were obviously much more critical in order to sort of point out that these things weren't a done deal and that even people like King obviously faced opposition and things like that. So I think there's more debate, I think, around this idea of kind of inevitable change. I think we don't kind of subscribe to that as much. So I think our British students are much more prepared to criticise the US openly from the get-go than I think American ones. It kind of takes some, not all of them, obviously some of them have deliberately come here because they want to have those conversations outside of a US classroom, I guess.
Sure. I think part of the difference might be the periods we specialise in. So yours, Megan, is immediately relevant to them in a way that the Civil War seems remote. American students may not know as much as they think they know, and British students will know very little.
Mm-hmm.
And for my period of the American Revolution,
could be a million years ago.
Yeah, and so that's also a factor. Mm-hmm. Right? And people have less invested in the narrative in each case. Though I occasionally get British students who are really keen to make, you know, Britain wasn't that bad during the American Revolution. I say, I know that, but but they're just not as invested in it in the same way. I think they.
Mm.
Contemporary relevance of your material, Megan, lends itself to that kind of both those discussions, but also perhaps that transatlantic divergence.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a difference between the way it's taught in England and Scotland, which have different curriculums?
Yeah, I mean, technically it could be, but there's the English curriculum is more prescriptive around these things in terms of like specific topics that kind of have to be covered. And the Scottish system is different, and it has less, obviously there aren't as many options. That's the kind of immediate obvious thing, is that obviously just in terms of population, you know, the Scottish qualifications bodies don't create as much because they don't need to.
Mm.
And so, you know, I it's not something that is immediately, you know, it's not something that's compulsory in either country, I suppose, is the easiest answer. So it's actually not possible to have a kind of clear cut, this is what people do in the UK, or even this is what they do in England, or this is what they do in Scotland. It's optional at all stages and in all parts of the UK, so it's quite difficult to deduce a national picture, I think.
Do you notice a difference between English and Scottish students and their approach to the civil rights movement? So basically, the question I asked you before, but asking you to compare American and British students, what about if it's an intra-British discussion?
Not that I would draw out, right. I don't think. I think it depends where they're from. I think some, even within England or even within Scotland, I think if people are from, especially in recent years where some cities have obviously made a conscious effort to try and acknowledge their own legacies of slavery. So, you know, places like Bristol, Glasgow, Liverpool, students who are from those cities are sometimes a little bit more conscious. So when you try and kind of draw out, is there any connections with the UK? They'll sort of say, oh, well, you know, in Bristol they did this, or in Liverpool they're doing this, or I went to the slavery museum in Liverpool or something. But it tends to be more rooted in their kind of like personal experiences or things that they've kind of pursued. It's certainly not something that they're getting from their kind of mainstream education. So I think it's more personal than that, you know, either that they've taken a personal interest or they live somewhere where it's kind of become.
And of course, presumably, if they're of Afro-Caribbean or African or South Asian background, it may resonate in different ways than for some of our other students from the UK.
Definitely, but I think the kind of asterisk to that would be, but we have very, very few students would meet that.
Yes.
So yes, in the rare times when there is someone of colour in my classrooms, it's something that they sometimes. Obviously we'll address in a more overt way, but it's very, very rare that we get those opportunities because we don't get many students of colour at this university.
That's
certainly
true.
Not in our department anyway.
So that's true. There's a long British tradition, which I ask you to comment on, when it comes to the American Civil Rights Movement. I mean, there's a long historiography, there's a long tradition of it's probably, correct me if you think I'm wrong about this, but I think it's probably the most popular single topic for British postgraduates working on the United States to do.
Mm.
So there are quite a few British historians of the U.S. Civil Rights Movement. I guess I'd ask you first to kind of comment on your own research, which we haven't really asked you about. We've danced around, talked about your teaching, but not your research. So how did you get into this? So if you could kind of reflect on that, but also maybe this broader historiographical tradition, if you could, and where you think it, how you think it fits and relates to the way, the historiography of the civil rights movement in the US.
Mm. So, yeah, I suppose in terms of my own, how I got here, I didn't initially start out as even kind of in history. So I, as I mentioned before, I started, my undergraduate was in American Studies, and I was actually more sort of literature focused in terms of my initial interests, and my dissertation, my undergraduate dissertation was on Moby Dick, and
wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
and Flannery O'Connor, so it was a kind of engagement with sort of religious themes in American literature and how Melville spends all of his time protesting. I don't believe in God. You can't say I believe in God. Who said I believed in God? Whereas obviously for O'Connor, it's something that was at the forefront of everything she was trying to do, but how it kind of permeated both of them, you know, regardless. And then I, with my master's, I continued to do stuff around O'Connor, and it kind of broadened out into a more general idea of kind of Southern exceptionalism, and how despite O'Connor's kind of religious ideas, she was very much writing for she wanted as many people as possible to read her books because she wanted to get that religious message put across. But the kind of O'Connor legacy is massively protected by a very insular bunch of, you know, scholars in the US, particularly in the South, in Georgia particularly, that basically say this literature only makes sense if you're from a very specific part of Georgia, and if you're not, you don't possibly get a chance to comment on it. And so I looked at adaptations of her work and how people have tried to take her out of the South a little bit, and how some of these scholars are kind of pulling her back in, and how I actually think that limits her. And so I started out much more interested in the South rather than the civil rights movement particularly, and I wanted to work on kind of Southern exceptionalism in cinema and different ways in which it becomes obvious. And through the kind of research and fleshing out what I wanted to do for my PhD, the civil rights movement just stood out as obviously, you know, the biggest moment in modern Southern, if not American, history, where our perceptions of the region have been either redeveloped or refostered or kind of entrenched. Mm. And so in terms of, if you're thinking about the South in popular culture in the 20th century, the civil rights movement is the moment where our perceptions of the South become completely entrenched in this idea of racial conflict, of kind of divisions within whiteness, good whites, bad whites, and the way that it's framed in the media at the time, and how that's then kind of trickled down into kind of popular culture and cinema today, and how that then influences our perception of what a social movement, or particularly an African-American movement, looks like or could look like today. So I didn't actually come at it from a civil rights perspective. I came at it more as this is a big moment in Southern history that has affected how the South is viewed. Mm. And actually nothing that is created about the South since that point doesn't or can't, you know, there's always that lens of race over everything. Even if a film doesn't overtly engage with race, it's kind of always there in some way. So I actually came at it more from a kind of Southern history perspective and kind of ideas of the South as different and why that matters, rather than specifically from a civil rights historian lens, I guess. But yeah, it's interesting that it has been such a significant field in this country. And why that might be. I honestly think some of it, if we look back, is probably rooted in this, again, as I've said before, where for a lot of people it's their first engagement with race.
Hmm.
For British scholars, it's, you know, it's particularly people who are kind of, you know, 20, 30 years ahead of me. If we're talking about how little of that stuff is taught in schools now, you know, I imagine for many of the scholars, you know, of my supervisor's generation and beyond, that was probably, you know, realistically, one of the things that hooked them initially, I imagine, is the idea that they've never thought about some of this stuff. And, you know, if these are people who potentially were born or grew up in the 60s, and obviously Britain's undergoing its own kind of really overt racial tensions, then those connections, I think, are probably more apparent maybe for people of that generation than they maybe are for, you know, my generation or the students that we teach potentially.
Yeah, I once had a conversation with a British historian of the US civil rights movement, considerably older than you, even older than me, if you can believe that. And one of the things he said to me was, because I asked him a version of this question, Megan, and he said, well, it's actually an advantage being an outsider. If you're a white historian working on civil rights, if you're a northerner, you might not be able to get people to talk to you. But if you're not American, and in fact, if you're British, yeah. because Americans of various races basically like British people and have a good receipt. Oh, I love your accent. Yeah. And, you know, stuff. But there's a willingness, particularly on the behalf of African-Americans, in his view, to speak to British scholars, particularly if they're doing oral history, in a way they wouldn't necessarily speak to white Americans.
I think that's true. I mean, I've been in situations and places in the South where people have kind of sort of said, you know, what are you doing here? Or they're kind of not particularly enamored by your presence, and as soon as you open your mouth, they're like, oh, it's fine. You know, and they literally, you see them relax. I would kind of echo that. I mean, as I've said, because the majority of my research has been more kind of popular culture, I've not really done a huge amount of kind of oral history or anything like that. But even just from being in the South and being, you know, being around people and just wanting to be nice to people and be friendly, it is quite stark how visibly people relax when they realise that you're not white American.
Right. So what specifically was your PhD dissertation on? I don't think you told us that.
Yeah, so my PhD is on basically how civil rights cinema presents ideas of kind of divisions within whiteness.
Right.
And so Southern identity and the kind of morality play of the civil rights movement that gets told time and time again isn't as simple as obviously black versus white. It's often actually rooted in things that centre white experiences and actually good white versus bad white. And usually good whites are secular, they have quite northern or kind of national identities, either because they are northern or because they've spent a lot of time outside of the South. Mm-hmm. And they kind of become these sort of national figures that then lead the kind of the rest of the white South along the path. And then the bad Southerners tend to be overtly religious. Mm-hmm. And there's this kind of message that basically if you're stupid enough to be religious, you're probably stupid enough to be racist. And there's a kind of complete denigration of kind of working class Southern evangelicalism that kind of creates these divisions. And so if you actually think back to so many of the kind of civil rights, you know, kind of white savior narratives that we get year after year, how often the villains are Klansmen, but they often have quite overt religious iconography, obviously the Klan being an obvious example of that. But they're usually religious, whereas the people who are the good Southerners are usually completely secular.
Interesting.
And so the first example that I start with, really, one of my big chapters is actually on To Kill a Mockingbird, and how in the novel, Atticus Finch talks openly about how he couldn't stand up in church, and he talks about church a lot, and the Finches go to church, whereas in the movie they don't.
Mm-hmm.
Because we have to create this wall that they are this kind of secular example of Americanness, and they're not, you know, they're not the kind of white trash Southerners that some of the that the Yules are. So that kind of, and then basically that that idea of secular and American versus kind of evangelical Southern was established at the time. It was established in the 60s, if it wasn't already, and then it's kind of trickled down in every manifestation of the movement that we've seen in popular culture.
There's an interesting parallel with Civil War films when they start to think about race, where even if the story is ostensibly about African Americans, they make the main character white.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's things like Glory,
which
of course is about the 54th Massachusetts Regiment, the first black regiment, one of the first black regiments in the Union Army. The main character, the only one who's historically based on somebody in the movie.
Yeah.
Is a white guy, you know, and you say the same thing with like Amistad. I guess those are all sort of contemporaneous with, you know, like Mississippi Burning and other things, where it's movies about race and racism, but that center white actors. And I guess that has to do with Hollywood and what Hollywood thinks they can make money with.
So Alan Parker, who directed Mississippi Burning, he openly said at the time that this film wouldn't have been made if it wasn't centered on white men. And so obviously in that there's a, you know, they obviously center on two FBI agents obviously going into Mississippi during Freedom Summer, but you don't see any black activism whatsoever. Most of the black characters don't speak at all, and so it did face some criticism obviously at the time. And he quite openly said, well, that's the only way that I could make this film.
Sure.
And I think he was kind of referring to his own kind of sense of what he could make in terms of what he could identify with, but also the realities of kind of Hollywood funding and what could get funded at that time.
When does that change? When do we start to see...
Has it changed?
Well, I've seen at least a handful of civil rights films that center the black experience more so than Mississippi Burning does.
Yeah, I mean, the main film that I write about in my PhD that I think signified at least our moment was Selma.
Mm-hmm.
But then obviously since then we've had Green Book.
Yes.
And, you know, so I don't think that I don't think Selma was by any means the kind of end point of the kind of white savior narrative, obviously, but it did obviously centralize this as a black story in a way that hadn't really been seen in at least in a major kind of mainstream Hollywood engagement with civil rights. They're very, very few. There's, you know, because there always is this tendency to focus it on white characters, but then to create, as I said before, this idea of like divisions within whiteness, mm-hmm. where we're not saying that all whites are good, however we need to redeem some of us by clinging to these kind of savior narratives rather than it being a kind of black story. But yeah, there's actually very, very few films that do that.
So it sounds as though your interdisciplinary background as both an undergraduate and as a master's student really prepared you to take this work on.
Yeah, exactly. And I think my supervisor would probably, I think, still finds it hilarious that I am classed as a historian now, because he kind of made a similar transition because he predominantly worked on music. So Brian Ward was my supervisor. So he predominantly worked on music and obviously, you know, used that as a lens into kind of civil rights history, I guess. So yeah, but he even, you know, years ago when I first started engaging with Hotchkiss, historians of the 20th century US, he said, "But you're not a historian." it's definitely interdisciplinary, and so I do think that that's something that the students sort of pick up on, and I think in a traditional institution like this, we don't actually have much movement between disciplinary boundaries often, and I think they respond quite well to it when it's encouraged.
So do you teach it in that way as well? I mean, do you, when you teach civil rights, you take an interdisciplinary approach?
Yeah, I mean, probably not as much as I would if I was in a more American studies environment. I'm aware that, you know, we are a history department and our students are predominantly history students. So I don't do it as overtly as I think I potentially would elsewhere, but I'm very open to students who want to take it in that direction. So I kind of make as many gestures as I can, and I bring films in as much as I can to show them that this is a valid form of kind of engaging with history, and these are the frameworks for doing that. But I'm also not going to expect everyone who's expecting a more kind of traditional history course to, I'm not expecting everyone to kind of go out and become, you know, film historians overnight, because I know that makes some of them really uncomfortable. Mm. But I make it as obvious as possible that I will support that kind of work.
Yeah. Well, I think it's really important because, I mean, that's, film is the way in which most people around the world engage with history. They don't, you know, as much as we wish they'd all read our monographs, you know, even a movie that doesn't do very well in the box office is going to have a lot more eyes glued to it, and the images are going to be embedded in a way that you know, lots of historical writing isn't. So you know, even, you know, bad movies have a tremendous impact in the ways in which people understand the past. So definitely, it's important for historians to understand that.
Yeah. I definitely, with the, obviously, the kind of pathway type courses that we do here, I do those in a much more kind of overtly interdisciplinary way, because the whole point of them is, you know, this is a form of historical writing and engagement that, you know, this is how I do it. And so, like, with my, the stuff I do on Southern exceptionalism, that's always rooted in film. And so we watch a film each week. And it actually works really well as a teaching tool, even regardless of whether the students then go on to do work in that vein, because if you want to get a class talking, show them a film, because everyone will have something to say. Whereas if you give them a fairly complicated reading or a kind of theoretical, you know, they might not. And quite often they'll sort of say, "I was halfway through that film and I could not work out why you made us watch it for a history class." And then it kind of clicks with them. And so one of the films I use a lot is Cape Fear.
Oh, right. Which one?
Well, mainly the second one, but then I kind of show
the
them
one with De Niro.
And I show them bits of both, but I make them watch the second one in total, because to me, that is a classic post civil rights Southern narrative where there isn't a single black character in it, but there's so much engagement with kind of Confederate iconography and kind of ideas of kind of white trash identity that I think we're definitely meant to believe that that character is also racist. It's just because we've already associated all of those things together because of so many of the other things we've seen about the South. And that's always the one where, because the others are quite obvious, like Mississippi Burning is clearly a historical film, despite its liberties that it takes. Mm. Obviously, Selma is a historical film, The Butler. But Cape Fear is always the one where they're like, well, that's just a kind of Scorsese thriller. And then that's always the one that they will not stop talking about. And I always get the most essays on because they just, it's just the gift that keeps on giving. If you want to, if you want to engage with kind of post civil rights ideas of the South, it's just, there's just so much you can do with that film.
Are you a Doctor Who fan?
No.
Oh, okay. The reason why I asked, there was a really good episode last year in which they visited the Montgomery bus boycotts, and they were trying to work. Then they met Martin Luther King, and but the two companions were they were British minorities. Mm-hmm. And so one was of African descent, one was South Asian, and so they were sort of dealing with the problems looking at the civil rights movement, but then connecting that, thinking about our earlier discussion, to the struggles they had faced in Britain as minorities,
right?
And you know.
Yeah.
So I recommend the Doctor Who episode about, you know.
Yeah. I knew that they'd kind of done the Rosa Parks stuff, and it's one of those things that I definitely should watch, but I really don't like Doctor Who.
Oh, that's, well.
So it's kind of
it
like.
It is an acquired taste. Frank, they're fist bumping right now, and they're exiling me as the nerd in the room, and that's, you know, I'm used to that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh.
That's definitely, if you're, anyway. I mean, so the films you mentioned are all sort of mainstream, like Hollywood films. I think.
Yeah.
What are some films that people may not have heard of that you think do interesting things with the civil rights movement?
Do they, in terms of time, do they have to be recent or do they have to?
You pick. Give us some of the things to watch that we may not have seen that you think are worth our time or do something interesting.
Okay, so the first one I would probably say is called Gone Are the Days, which is a Ozzie Davis. He originally wrote it as a play, and it was on Broadway for a long time, and it's was originally called Pearly Victorious and then became Gone Are the Days. And it's basically about it's set on a plantation, and he plays a kind of preacher figure on a plantation. But it was written and kind of first produced in the early 60s.
Hmm.
So whilst it's set on a plantation, he's using a lot of kind of civil rights and even kind of early black power rhetoric to try and encourage fellow slaves to kind of rebel in various ways, to the point that they eventually, it's very funny. It's very kind of like farcical kind of physical comedy. And it's, I think you can watch it on YouTube because it's so, you know, because basically it completely tanked at the time when it came out. But so there's very little, and Ozzie Davis himself tried to distance himself from it because I think he was embarrassed. But the actual film itself
is a comedy.
Yeah, yeah, and so
that's quite brave. Yeah, 1960 something. Yes.
And one of the reasons why people think it tanked is because it came out immediately after the Birmingham bombing of where the four little girls were killed, and so I think there was a sense of like this stuff isn't funny. But I think what he's obviously was trying to do was try and use a lot of this rhetoric in a way that wasn't offensive to whites and was kind of deliberately provocative, but through comedy. And I think, you know, I think it works really well, and it genuinely is very, very funny. But he kind of uses civil rights rhetoric and kind of takes it onto a plantation and creates this kind of farcical comedy of a slave rebellion that the kind of master of the plantation is so shocked that he literally just drops dead because he can't comprehend that they would ever even speak back to him. But it's all done in a really kind of it's genuinely really interesting in terms of the rhetoric and some of that stuff that would never have been said in a kind of in a mainstream film. You know, some of the language, like, you know, he's quite openly saying, you know, black is beautiful, and you know, he's using that very kind of contemporary rhetoric of the time. So that would definitely be one of them. It's just a kind of interesting and strange watch in itself. And I would love to do more work on that at some point in the future. Malcolm X apparently went to see it on Broadway.
Really?
And loved it, yeah. And one of the other reasons why they think it didn't do very well, apart from the really bad timing, was that it had been on Broadway and so many people had seen it that the actual make of the film is just a kind of scene-by-scene remake.
Hmm.
And it doesn't feel very cinematic. And so I think a lot of people just thought, well, what's the point of spending money to go and see something I've already seen on Broadway? And the other one would be Nothing But a Man, which I don't know if you've seen that. So that was 1964, and that is basically centres on an African-American man who's kind of moved around a lot for work, and he comes back into Birmingham, Alabama, which is his hometown, and he essentially kind of does all sorts of kind of menial labour jobs and tries to encourage his kind of workmates to basically strike and to strike for better conditions and to, you know, obviously to be better respected. And he comes up against a lot of resistance, and he's kind of presented as, again, similar to some of the kind of general Southern exceptional ideas where because he's lived and worked elsewhere, he's more likely to challenge the system, even though he is a Southerner himself. But he comes up against this constant kind of opposition, not only from kind of white power structures, but also from, you know, other African-American men who don't want to speak up and are kind of scared, obviously, for their livelihoods, for their lives, and he's kind of really frustrated by everyone in the South and kind of sees it as this kind of really repressive place. But in terms of it being like a black-centred story from 1964, it's a really interesting kind of comparison with the other things that are coming out at the time, like To Kill a Mockingbird and things that were rather pretty tone deaf to the realities of what was actually happening. And it's got a really great like Motown soundtrack as well. Yeah. So. that's got two white directors, but one of whom was a Jewish refugee and talked a lot about his own kind of personal sympathies with African Americans because of his own experiences in Europe, and so they were quite open about the fact that, you know, we're white and we're making this film, but they had their main work previous to that had been in documentary. So it's very kind of the way it's filmed and stuff is quite interesting. So it's kind of meant to be like a window into black life in the early 60s.
Cool.
Right. Excellent.
Thanks to add to the watch list. Yeah. Okay.
So, well, that's really fascinating, Megan. Thank you so much. And great to hear about your work. But one of the things we talked about before we came on the air was how much we should say about current events in turn. And so I'd be interested to hear your view as a British person who studies the United States. Well, take your pick. You can either reflect on the election results we've just had here as of last Friday, or the impending and one assumes successful impeachment vote that is being held. The debate's going on right now,
as we speak.
The vote will happen sometime in the course of this afternoon in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really have any opinions about either of those things.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose in terms of the impeachment, the main thing I would say is that I suppose the main connection that people make, and certainly that students ask me about, is, you know, how does this relate to Nixon, and how does this relate to obviously previous impeachments. The other thing being that I've just finished up a course on the American South since the Civil War, so we're trying to make as many Andrew Johnson connections as possible. But obviously Nixon kind of is more framed in people's minds. And so I did think it was quite interesting to see that the statistics around, you know, the polls around Americans who believe that he should be impeached are actually higher than they were for Nixon, which I think is really interesting, because whilst Nixon obviously wasn't ever actually impeached, that sense of that's the kind of pinnacle idea of what a dodgy president looks like now.
Sure.
And so the fact that more Americans think Trump should be impeached than Nixon, I think, is quite interesting for us to reflect on.
And sooner, really, if you think about
how long the Watergate kind of dragged out for, and I suppose how much more popular and established Nixon was given his sort of 72 landslide and things like that. So I suppose from a historical perspective, I find that quite interesting, because students are sort of, on the one hand, this doesn't seem anywhere near as big and pronounced and as Watergate, but actually the figures would suggest otherwise, that actually there is more momentum behind this than there was for Watergate. So I don't know if you have opinions on that.
Well, it does seem that you know, the turning point for Nixon was when he lost the majority of popular support. You know, what statistic everyone cites, that 50% of people wanted him removed from office the week he resigned. We've already got 50% of people now who want, and there's no sign that's actually going to lead to anything beyond impeachment in the House. So,
yeah.
I think it's we don't know yet.
I mean, the trial has to work itself.
I mean, you're right. And if I were going to bet on this, I would think he's not. I don't think he's going to be removed as a result of this. But we don't know.
But there was a sense in, I think, in the 70s that both the House and the Senate, which were both controlled by the Democrats, would defer not only to their political allegiances, but also to the popular will about what to do about a president who conducted criminal activities. Now, I think there's the sense that the Republicans in the Senate are not interested in doing anything.
That's right. Well, and I think
that's... And they've said that, you know.
Some of them
have said that. Others of them said they're concerned.
Yes. Susan Collins is very concerned.
Yes.
But we don't know how this is necessarily going to play. I mean, the key difference between 1974 and today, well, there are many, but the one that seems to me most relevant is the different media landscape.
Mm. Mm.
So the people who aren't in the 50, well, the Fox News poll, which is interesting, it was Fox News, that really shocked people a few days ago, was 50% supporting impeachment and removal and 54% supporting impeachment.
Mm-hmm.
So there are 4% who want impeachment but not removal.
Mm-hmm.
But that's pretty striking. But the crucial difference, notwithstanding the fact that was a Fox poll, is that if you're a Fox viewer, you're getting a very different view of all of these events than if you're not.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that would apply to members of Congress and senators as well, both in terms of their voters or their supporters, depending on their districts, but also the view of the world they themselves have.
Mm-hmm.
To be sure.
So I think that's a crucial thing. What about last week's election here in the UK, Megan? Any?
These are fresh wounds here, Frank.
Yeah. Well, painful stuff. I think, I suppose what's been frustrating but not completely surprising is the way that obviously since the even the initial exit poll was fairly spot on, and you know, in terms of obviously it doesn't always get the numbers exactly right, but it was pretty obvious which way it was going.
Well, didn't have to stay up all night.
Well, I did, unfortunately. I stayed up till, you know, nearly 6 in the morning. I don't know why, because it was just getting progressively worse, obviously. Through some kind of self-torture, I did. And, I think...
You can't stop, can you? Because you always wait for one more result.
Yeah, it's always like, oh, they've said it'll, you know, they're going to announce Kensington in 5 minutes. So then you stay up for that and then it's, you know, whatever. And yeah, it was awful. I think what's been kind of frustrating but not particularly surprising is how immediately the left just attacks itself. There's just been, ever since that exit poll, it's, you know, it's Corbyn's fault, or it's this person's fault, or it's because it was too much about race, or it's not enough about race, or, you know, we've abandoned people in the heartlands, which is basically a code for white people, and a kind of complete lack of engagement with the fact that the places that did actually vote Labour and have consistently voted Labour for, you know, since the 1950s, since the kind of post-war government, but they never get referred to as the Labour heartland because they're very diverse communities, often in inner cities. And so I think that's been the most frustrating thing for me. And again, if we want to kind of bring in kind of comparisons with sort of US political discourse, how little commentary there is in this country about race and how little we actually engage with our own kind of issues around race and that kind of... what in America would be referred to as the kind of possessive investment in whiteness, the way that people vote is not talked about in any way. And I think we're really missing that level of political dialogue around, you know, race and kind of whiteness and identity in this country that is, I think people would kind of deflect onto the Brexit vote, but I think is much more complicated than that.
Well, yes, much of the analysis since last Friday has been Labour lost the working class.
Yeah.
Well, Labour lost the white working class, not the non-white working class.
Exactly, and so the way that, as you know, this idea of Labour heartlands, which basically means the north of England, but it means white people in the same way that when people say working class, they actually mean white people, because we know that working class people of colour clearly voted Labour, and that's not up for debate, but we don't really talk about that.
Mm.
And so... this idea that Labour needs to move into the centre and it needs to reattract those kind of white working class voters is quite a dangerous, it's a kind of dangerous rhetoric to be rooted in if that means abandoning the people who have actually voted for you in order to swing somewhat to the right, I think is... But yeah, it's just frustrating to see all of this kind of hand-wringing and blame and not actually addressing the people who did vote and why they voted Labour. It's quite sad, but unfortunately not that surprising.
Yeah. Well, we live in interesting political times on both sides of the Atlantic.
We do, yes.
So
time for last drops. And yeah. Megan, since you're our guest, you wanna go first?
Yeah, so I suppose the thing that kind of struck me as a potential last drop for today is that today, the 18th of December, is the 75th anniversary of the Korematsu decision, the US Supreme Court Korematsu versus United States, which obviously effectively was the Supreme Court approving the internment of Japanese Americans during World War II, which has now obviously undergone significant kind of... has been indicted many, many times by the Supreme Court subsequently, but has never actually been overturned.
Mm-hmm.
So it was something that Trump himself has kind of appealed to as a way to obviously target migrants from Muslim countries, where he basically he's used Korematsu as a potential precedent. It's never actually been overtly used as a precedent, but certainly in the rhetoric, despite the fact that obviously the Supreme Court itself has often referred to it as a really kind of poor decision and a really problematic decision. So it's an interesting time to reflect on it and its legacy in the 75 years, and the fact that whilst it's been kind of rebutted many times, it's never actually been officially overturned, and how that then links into how it can then potentially still be weaponized by people like Trump against other kind of minority groups.
Yes, because historically it's always been seen as a kind of shameful verdict,
decision. Yeah,
and we wouldn't imagine somebody would say this. What's next? He's going to say, hey, Dred Scott, great decision.
Exactly. But it shows, that these things, if they're on the books, they're on the books. And, we don't know who could potentially use them in the future, even if they've been debunked in our own time. So that's another is a very interesting one to teach with students, because they see it today as well.
Sure. Eric, what you got?
You should go first, David. Mine's happier than yours.
Korematsu,
I think yours follows on from Megan's than mine.
So a few weeks ago I endorsed the TV show Watchmen on HBO, the first episode of which begins with the 1921 Tulsa massacre, which is an episode in which Black Tulsa was very prosperous and white supremacists destroyed it, and it's a important moment in the show, and the show is very good, and the show has just finished its final episode, and it harks back to that moment at various points in time. Highly recommend the show. Thing that got announced this week, and I don't know whether they were trying to tie it in with the show or not, but seems like they were. The University of Oklahoma seems to have located a mass grave connected with the massacre from 1921. They've done some ground penetrating radar and seem to have identified, and they're not entirely sure yet. They've only started to do the initial archaeological work to figure out how many bodies are there and what state of preservation they're in, but I think it's doing a wonderful thing. It's it's an awful event, but it's great. I think that this TV show has made people aware of it, and now we have this archaeological evidence that's going to hopefully then allow people to deal with a very traumatic event in American history in a way that it's been largely forgotten. So. Good for HBO for highlighting this episode, and good for the archaeologist at Oklahoma for doing some work to help document more of it.
Excellent. Good.
Frank, what you got?
In fact, Megan and I should not have bumped fists in disdain of Doctor Who a few minutes ago, because I'm about to acknowledge and celebrate the arrival of Star Wars, the latest Star Wars film, The Rise of Skywalker, tomorrow, which is, it starts at midnight tonight.
Yes.
I'm a little surprised David's not going to see it at midnight.
There are complicated family reasons for that. I lobbied for it, I got voted down.
Well, I'm glad to see democracy is alive and well somewhere.
Exactly.
So you're seeing it tomorrow. Megan, when are you seeing it?
Hopefully over the next week, but yeah, I don't have specific
plans. We have a lot of marking to do. Yeah. I'm seeing it on Friday. I'm very excited about this because I'm the only one in this room, because I am a little bit older than each of you, who can remember seeing the original Episode 4, A New Hope, in 1977 in the cinema. I went for my birthday. Now, birthday parties weren't a big deal back then in the Stone Age. So I went with a couple of my friends, and that was my birthday party. I'm not going to tell you which birthday it was. but you know, so I've been with this thing since the beginning, and there are three trilogies now, but really 11 films and plus TV series and
books and video games and all kinds of great stuff.
There's the canon and the non-canon and everything else. But I, on one level, I'm happy to see it all. It's not really coming to an end, of course, but this cycle coming to an end of three trilogies. Mm. But I'm quite excited to see it. There was a very nice review in the New York Times this morning that didn't have any spoilers in it, so you can read it, which basically said, it's not a great film, but it's not meant to be a great film. Anyway, I'm looking forward to it. Yeah. It's got a history and an internal logic all its own. In fact, I have debated the history of the Star Wars universe with David's children at one point.
Oh, yes.
When I had the temerity to question the timeline, something I'll never ever again do. They've
inherited some of my proclivities.
So this is exciting to me personally because it speaks to my own personal history, as I suspect it does to many people my age around the world, but also has a kind of internal history to its own that kind of follows Gibbon's decline and fall of the Roman Empire. Mm-hmm. So,
I went to episode 6 for my birthday.
Okay.
Yes.
So... Well, that's the age difference between me and you, right? It's a little more than that.
Yeah, actually, yeah, I think it's a little more.
Let's just wrap
it
up. Yeah, exactly. Megan, thank you so much. Yes. We'd love to have you back.
Yes,
thank
definitely.
You. Yeah,
yes.
Cheers. Cheers.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at WhiskeyRebelPod and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.